Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Richard Horwitz from Potter Anderson here on behalf of DuPont, the appellee. And I'd like to introduce to some of the court and reintroduce to those that were here for the panel, John Sylvester from Kirkpatrick, Lockhart, Preston, Gates, and Ellis, who will be making the argument this morning for DuPont.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I will reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. My name is Brian Kasperzak, and I have a Marks O'Neill, O'Brien, and Courtney in Wilmington, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Stonewall Insurance Company. The Superior Court erred by failing to reduce DuPont's $235.6 million in total polybutylene limit liabilities by its $50 million post-1986 period self-insured retention. The primary issue on this appeal is whether DuPont must incur only one $50 million self-insured retention in the 1985 policy year, or whether DuPont must incur two such retentions, one in 1985 and one in the post-1986 period.
Is that really the issue, or is the issue whether or not liabilities that were allocated to the settlement of the post-1986 claims are basically taken out of the calculus and cannot be used again for purposes of adjudicating the 1985 year claims?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that those are integrally intertwined together in the same issue. The fact that those claims are taken out of play, as you're referencing, is due to the fact that they have to satisfy the initial $50 million SIR, which is the first layer below their getting any coverage from their excess carriers above that.
Well, two things. I'm trying to separate out the issue from the consequence. And my understanding, tell me if I'm wrong, is that that your analysis proceeds from the premise that once there's an allocation, even if for purposes of settlement of the post-1986 claims, that allocation is binding for all purposes on any adjudication of a different policy year.
Yes, that's correct.
And the result of that is that the 1985 SIR combined with the underlying coverage on top of that exceeds whatever coverages, whatever claims are left. Is that correct?
That's correct.
As a factual matter, can you tell us whether, the claims that were asserted and I suppose were involved in the settlement of the post-1986 year, were those all claims that were covered only by post-1986 policies or post-1985 policies, or was there an admixture?
We haven't gotten to a specific determination of the earlier claim periods, but from the fact that the policy by its nature only covers claims from 1986 forward, and our policy year ends in the end of 1985. So none of those claims for installations, and installation is the key here, that's when the claim can start. Installations in 86 and later cannot be put into the prior period and have to be put into that period for recovery on behalf of DuPont.
As I understand it, what is driving this dispute is the proposition that that although claims were utilized to settle the post-1986 policy year issues, those same claims can now be recycled back into the 1985 year for purposes of this litigation, correct?
We're attempting to say that they shouldn't be able to recycle claims that have already been paid and allocated.
That's the effort that's being made.
Yes, by saying that DuPont doesn't have to satisfy those $50 million worth of claims in the 86 period SIR, they're saying that they remain unpaid for it and should be put into the 85.
That would not be possible unless some of the claims that were utilized for the 1986 settlement would also be covered by the 1985 year policies.
That would require a specific analysis of each claim, which hasn't been done in this case. But from the facts of the case, 55.6% of the total claims are from the post-86 period. So you're correct that if it wasn't triggering that policy period, they wouldn't be able to put it into that year, but they haven't determined for us which years those claims are specifically for, and that's for later adjudication in this case.
So we're essentially operating in a vacuum here. We're arguing about a concept, but we don't really know what the facts are.
Well, there's no vacuum here. We know that 55.6% of the claims are in the 86 and post period, so that they couldn't trigger the prior period. So from straightforward, and this also ties into our argument regarding the litigation costs, that those litigation costs also couldn't possibly trigger the 1985 policy year. So from the straight numbers of the installations, which is the operative point here, we know that they can't trigger the year. Whether or not we get to the later litigation on the specific claims will have to be determined. But I believe there's no vacuum here. We're just determining that we get credit for the claims that have been allocated to the post-86 period for the policies, the SIRs, and also the difference of the policies that DuPont paid between the XL and the ACE agreement so that they could deem that the XL payment was satisfied in order to obtain the higher-level ACE policies.
What's your understanding of the reason that the trial judge didn't buy your argument?
We are a little confounded on why he didn't buy it. We believe that we pointed to the Treadwell case and the W.R. Graves case, that there's case law supporting the fact that case claims that have been allocated to a period should be binding. We believe that, it's clear that there's no counter case law that DuPont's presented that it shouldn't be. The litigation to judgment differentiation that's been brought up here is really not a distinction. There shouldn't be a distinction here. These policies are dealing with insurance companies over numbers of years that deal with policies that are all part of the litigation insurance program that DuPont has set up. They set up this program beginning from the first year to the end year. This is not something where we should just take a look at each one policy year. They set up this comprehensive plan. They were an active participant in sharing liability with their incurring the $50 million annual SIRs, and we're just trying to get proper credit for claims that have already been allocated to that.
I thought it was as simple, and usually when I think it's simple, there's something badly wrong with my analysis, so correct me when I mistake the analysis, but I thought the trial judge concluded, as far as the 1986 SIR was concerned, that you shouldn't get credit for it because in the post-1986 period, we're really talking about a period of time that didn't apply to your policy in the first place. Is that wrong?
I think we're getting back to the same distinction where we're trying to get a clear determination that policy, that period in which the claims were allocated to there, which, as we were also saying, is evidenced by the fact that they're post-1986 claims and therefore shouldn't be put to our period. We're also saying, in fact, DuPont affirmatively said that these claims were satisfied when they were tendering their claims to their post-86 carriers. And therefore, on both sides of the coin, we're saying they were satisfied, and then they also, because they're post-86, they can't put them into our policy year. So I think it's the same issue, just on different sides.
We are here presumably to interpret a contract. Do you rely upon any contractual language for your position?
Yes. I mean, we can point to, just as far as the XL and the ACE policies, there's specifically the loss payable clause that says that it shall not attach unless the underlying limits or retention are paid, and that's something that's included standardly in policies that, something they're trying to talk about with the XL initial agreement as well as the ACE later agreements, both incorporated the conditions of the policies. Even though they didn't specifically say it, they did specifically incorporate it, so it's not something that they're trying to get around the policy conditions.
But does the contract of insurance help us with figuring out how to allocate the expenses and whether an election by DuPont in the 1998 agreement somehow binds its rights with respect to the pre-86 insurers?
I believe that the fact that they selected that and settled with those carriers should be binding on them.
But is it binding as a matter of the terms of the contract, or is it your view it's binding because of some equitable notion, or is this simply a request by your client that this court rewrite the contract?
Well, first of all, DuPont made that representation in part of their settlement. So between the parties that contracted, it's binding. So
but your client's not one of those parties.
I agree. That's my initial statement, Your Honor.
And hasn't that contract been superseded anyway, so it's no longer of any force and effect?
The underlying Excel agreement was never superseded, and that one also still incorporates the policy terms. The second agreement never revisited the issue of whether the underlying policies were satisfied, and that was a presumption that was made in that final contract. The fact that we rely on the Treadwell and W.R. Grace case is our specific case law. While we do say it's extremely inequitable for DuPont to try to get around this $50 million SIR, we do also have the legal authority that allocations to other periods should be held binding when dealing with other carriers in other years.
Well, that's really the issue, isn't it? The effect of the settlement of the post-1986 claims. Is that right? What is the effect of the settlement of the post-1986 claims on the litigation concerning the 1985 policy year claims?
The,
is that a fair statement of the issue?
The settlement is just the...
Is that a fair statement of the issue, at least broadly speaking? That's a yes or a no.
I believe that's a no. That's the agreement evidences what resolution came about.
Excuse me. If it were not for the 1986 year settlement, we wouldn't be here on this first issue. Is that correct?
I agree that the policy... Yeah,
and if that's correct, then the reason we are here is because your client is taking the position that the allocations that were made for purposes of effectuating the 1986 or post-1986 year settlement somehow have a binding effect on the adjudication concerning the previous policy year claims. Is that correct?
Yes. The settlement agreements in the post-86 period are part of the factual underlying of why we're here. The assertion that we're just trying to make, and we're limiting it to the specific allocation situation where DuPont has specifically allocated claims to its post-86 period.
All I'm asking is whether it isn't fair to say that the settlement of the post-1986 claims, whatever that was, the issue is what legal effect, if any, that has on the adjudication of the issues that relate to the 1985 policy year claims.
Yes, and including the fact of how it addresses the underlying self-insured retention.
And to follow up on Vice Chancellor Noble's question, that's not an issue that's addressed in any of the policies. So we can't look to the policies for an answer to that.
I did reference the loss payable clause in which the policies do require that the underlying self-insured retention be paid before those.
But the policies talk about the effect of a settlement of claims for 1 year on claims relating to prior policy years where you have multi-year coverage?
No, they don't refer to that.
So and we're either relying then on an equitable notion or some principle of insurance law or contract law, is that correct?
Correct.
What is it?
The fact that claims allocated, again, to the post-86 period should be binding upon the insured.
Yes, based on what? Based on what structure of law?
We, again, went through the cases of Treadwell and W.R. Grace to the fact that when an insured allocates claims to a specific policy period, then it should be held to have those already be allocated when it tries to allocate other claims to another year with other carriers.
Those cases arise out of a different factual context, though, don't they?
It's not identical to this one, but I think the underlying principle goes to the fact of whether or not this is, and I'd like to get back to the distinction of whether or not this is a litigation to judgment or something that's outside of litigation. Part of DuPont's primary argument is they're trying to stand behind the position that since this wasn't part of an adjudication, therefore it should not be part of that. We're saying that that's a false differentiation here. The fact that whether they litigated with Ace and Excel or whether they settled with them without litigation doesn't make a distinction. The fact that they allocated a specific number of claims to that policy period should be binding on them when they deal with other periods.
Right. Well, we understand your point that DuPont should be bound by its allocation. Why don't you do a side-by-side comparison for us with real numbers? And let's assume first that DuPont never settled any claims with regard to the 86 policy. What is your client's exposure under its policies, and what would it get a credit for? That's the first question. And then let's say, but in light of the 86 policies, we get these additional credits, which is another way to frame your argument. So tell us first the total exposure you think your client has under its policies.
If there's no other credits and DuPont is presumably...
The number we start with, right. What's going to be the starting number?
Well, the starting number is that we have a $5 million policy limit for two policies.
The starting number I want to use is DuPont's claims. How many millions of dollars do they have claims for when they come to you?
$235.6 million in total. And what I would do is we would have to have some determination pursuant to Judge Vaughn's determination in the 2004 opinion of only claims that pass through a policy year can trigger that policy year. So we, at a minimum, we'd have to take the 55.6 out because we know that that's after our policy year. So we would take that out of the 253. Then we would also have to make a determination.
And what's our number then?
If approximately, I would say, maybe 115, if we just do an estimate.
So we have 115, and then you say to DuPont, you have to pay the first $50 million, correct?
Yes.
So then we have 65.
And we have other claims which we were arguing, such as claims that we argued out of that sum that were paid for pre-83 claims which were not actually DuPont's product. And I believe that's $24 million that we're claiming. So
41. We're down to 41 then.
And then also we're talking about the litigation costs, which I guess would have to be determined as well, which come through that period.
And that's a total of what, 74 or something like that?
$74 million, yes.
All right. So if we had the 74 and the 41 together, that would be what DuPont would be looking to your client for. Is that correct?
Well, the 74, I would qualify the fact that our argument is that they should only be able to allocate a portion of those claims. Again, we would probably, at a minimum, take out 55.6% of that. So if you get down to 30 or 35 million.
All right. Let's do that just to keep it simple. So now we have 76 million that DuPont wants from your client. Now, so that's the number. DuPont wants your client to pay $76 million. What do you claim you're entitled to get a credit for based on the fact that they've, you know, allocated these other claims to the 1986 settlement?
We're claiming that we're entitled to credit for any of those remaining claims in which they received a payment. Now, we also don't know in this scenario what payments they might have received from the 83, 84 carriers. That would also be something that we'd be entitled to for a credit, also for any other payments in the policy.
Well, that comes back to the Chief Justice's question, though. If they allocated the money because they thought that the 86 policy covered it, why are you getting credit for what those 86 policy carriers paid?
We're not getting credit for the fact that they paid it, but if they were underlying limits below ours. And part of this issue is also that in specifically the 85 year, some of the stacking layers of insurance policies were not able to be filled when DuPont set up its plan. So DuPont also has an additional $20 million of coverage in our policy year above the $50 million SIR. So depending on where you go in the layers, it's just going to depend. I'm not saying specifically because someone else paid we shouldn't, but it's also getting to who should pay before who, and that's some of the credit I was talking about.
Well, how do you factor into all of this that the Superior Court seemed to be influenced by the concept that when parties settle, you can take positions for the purpose of settling that shouldn't necessarily bind you later? And we know, for example, on the policy that was $75 million, they paid $67.5 million, and then as part of the settlement, DuPont had to give credit for $7.5 million. Why, as a matter of law, as Justice Jacobs said, should your settlement posture be binding?
It's basically what is equitable in the position of the insured and its insurers. DuPont should not be able to potentially have a double recovery. It's basically just trying to make sure that what claims remain unpaid are paid. So we're trying to get credits for amounts that are there, basically saying that those claims are satisfied, so they're taken out of the mix, not to the fact that we want to get some undue credit. We just don't want DuPont, who again has its annual $50 million SIR program it set up, as well as additional layers of it covers, paying its share. DuPont, in this case, took an unusually large self-insured retention. This is not a typical situation. Prior to this period, and even in the 60s, DuPont was totally self-insured. So they know what loss is about and how to protect for it and what it takes to cover it. Here, we're just trying to make sure that we get our proper credit and that they properly pay what they have under the agreements.
You're in your rebuttal time.
I'll
do you want to save the balance?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. President Judge Vaughn's ruling in this case, number one, just to restate it, I think, with regard to the principal issue, was that in terms of the 1985 insurers, including Stonewall, they get a credit for settlement dollars actually received by DuPont from the post-86 insurers, but they don't get any extra credit for monies that DuPont did not receive from those insurers which had overlapping coverage obligations. And that ruling, number one, is consistent with the policy language of Stonewall's policy, specifically the all sums language, which obligated it to provide all sums coverage with regard to all claims costs and litigation costs that trigger its policy period. Number two, it's consistent with the all sums ruling of this court in the Hercules decision. And number three, it's consistent with Delaware's long enunciated public policy in favor of promoting the voluntary settlement of claims and contested issues.
Counsel, is it fair to say that there's no case that really addresses circumstances like the ones that we have before us?
I think that is fair to say.
It's really a matter of first impression in terms of multiple year, multiple policy coverage problems.
Yes, this is a unique situation, but the burden, I believe, is on Stonewall, which is trying to, in essence, get around its own contractual coverage obligations to provide some compelling extra contractual reason.
Let me just ask a factual question.
I'm sorry?
A factual question relating to the settlement of the post-1986 claims. For purposes of that settlement, DuPont presented a bundle of claims, correct?
Yes.
Were those claims all exclusively post-1986 claims? That is, were they claims that were covered only by the post-1986 policies?
No. The $235 million worth of claims not only triggered the post-86 period, but 44% of them would also trigger the pre-86 period. In other words, because of the continuous trigger and the all sums joint and several liability, in essence, the 83-year insurers would cover all of those claims installed in 83. The 84-year insurers would cover all of those claims installed in 83 and 84. The 85-year insurers, of which Stonewall is a member, would cover all of those claims where the installation was in either 1983, 1984, or 1985. And then the so-called post-86 insurers would have responsibility for the entire bundle. We presented this entire bundle to
That's because these claims were all of a continuing variety, so that whoever was at the end of the chain, that is, whatever insurer was at the end of the chain, could be liable to cover all of them.
That's right. I mean, the parties stipulated, and it's in the record, the stipulation, that for purposes of determining when property damage occurred in these particular claim situations, that property damage was continuous and progressive from the date of installation until an end date, which, although we didn't define it, it was well past any of the years that are necessary to trigger coverage in these policies.
Okay. The claim that's being made here, or I should say the argument that's being made here, is that whatever allocation was made by the settling parties with respect to the post-1986 year claims should be binding with respect to the adjudication of the 1985 year claims. My question is, does the record show whether or not there was an allocation?
The record shows that there was not such a allocation. There are two post-86 insurers with whom DuPont settled. The first is XL, and again, they actually reinsured DuPont's captive, but for all intents and purposes, they were our insurer. The record, and if you want to look at the agreement itself, it's at B64 through 71 of the appendix. The record shows that we presented a whole bunch of claims to XL, just like we did to the pre-86 insurers. We said, we want you to pay your limits of $75 million. We had the usual arm wrestling that goes on in the settlement negotiation. They agreed to pay us a lump sum of $67.5 million. We gave them a release from all past, present, or future claims with regard to coverage for these liabilities.
To be very precise, are you saying that there's no document in the record that reflects any kind of allocation?
There is one document, and that's what I would call the initial ACE funding agreement, which they rely completely on. I mean, their whole argument is premised on an initial agreement that was voided and superseded by a final agreement with ACE. And
if that was the 75% payout agreement?
That's the initial payout agreement that they've been holding, you know, basically basing their entire argument on. And it's an agreement that has been superseded. And if I could just give the background to Your Honors about that agreement. And after we settled with XL, then we went to ACE, which was the next higher insurer. And at the same time, we're making these same claims with these same dollars to the pre-86 insurers. It's just that the post-86 insurers were more interested in talking settlement with us early. And what ACE said is that we'll start providing you funding for reimbursement because we don't want to fight with you right now about this, but we want to see what the claims experience is before we ultimately decide what our final resolution of this is going to be. And so we agreed to an agreement, the so-called initial ACE agreement in 1998, which is at B72 through 93 of the appendix. And in that agreement, they said we'll provide funding on a basis of 75% of claims dollars of the total being allocated to the post-86 period. However, first of all, you have to give 11% of that back under the loss stabilization agreement, which was signed at the same time. So we never got 75% even in the beginning. Secondly, they reserved all of their rights and defenses on coverage. And their position was that they were going to settle up finally at a later time after they saw how the claims experience progressed. We ended up continuing to fight about them. They continued to assert their coverage defenses. They asserted, even throughout the time they were paying us money, that they had no coverage obligation and they ought to get all of their money back. And we even went into arbitration with them over in London. We settled before the arbitration was finalized, and we reached an agreement, the so-called 2005 agreement, which is at B734 to 66 in the appendix. And if you read that agreement, there's no allocation of 75% or any percent to the post-86 insurance period. What the agreement did was it said, all right, with respect to all of the claims dollars that you have paid out, DuPont, over the past however many years, up until December 31 of 2004, we're going to determine that we will pay $41.5 million total, which is well less than 75% on a 75% basis. We ended up having to pay them back money that we had billed them under the 75% arrangement where they initially funded us. And in addition, they got to keep the $4 million or so that we had paid them all through that time period in reimbursements under the loss stabilization clause.
Okay, so the initial agreement was basically a facility to move cash from one party to the other, pending a final settling up at the end of some period.
That's right.
And it wasn't binding in terms of the settling up process.
Absolutely not. We ended up having to renegotiate a whole different deal, which was very much akin to a lump sum payment for all of the dollars that we had spent as of the end of December of 2004. We basically agreed on a number that they'll pay $41.5 million. Now, they did agree for all of the expenses that we incur from January 105 forward they'll either reimburse us 50% or 60%, depending on the nature of the claims expense, which, by the way, is, you know, pretty close to the 55.6% that we had determined by analyzing the individual claims that is allocable to the post-86 period in terms of those claims that had installations first starting in the post-86 period and beyond. And so it's under that basis that they are reimbursing us some money for recent year expenses. But essentially, we had a lump sum agreement with ACE as well. And there's nowhere in that agreement where we agree to a 75% allocation such that 75% of our total is used to exhaust their underlying coverage and then to exhaust both the SIR and the XL agreement and then start paying into the ACE agreement. Nowhere is that existent in that agreement, and I would encourage you to look at it.
What number would you say is the exposure of Stonewall for its policy?
Okay.
The total exposure.
Well, and you asked that question. It was a good question, Justice Holland. It was determined that of the $162 million claims cost, as opposed to indivisible litigation costs, that 44.4% of them were allocable to the pre-85 period because of installation either in 83, 84, or 85. So that is $72 million of the $162 million that our claims cost, that is claim settlements for replumbing homeowners' homes that are that trigger the 1985 year. And in addition to that, there's $74 million of indivisible defense costs, which trigger all of the years and are the joint and several responsibility of all years. So it's a total of $146 million of total dollars that we could place into the 85 year. Now, because we've gotten $109 million total of settlement dollars from the post-86 insurers, if you subtract that from our total loss, our total ultimate net loss is only $126 million. And so that $146 million potential responsibility of the 85 year is reduced, and Judge Bond has ruled that it's reduced as a result of those settlements down to $126 million.
And that is the only effect of the settlement of the post-1986 claims.
That's right. That is what President Judge Vaughn ruled, and that is what would be consistent under the law and under the public
policy. You agree that DuPont would then have to give a credit for $50 million against the $126 million?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So then you'd be looking for $76
million. From the 85 insurers over and above the $50 million SIR. Stonewall, interestingly enough, is in the first and second layer. Their insurance policies cap out at the $70 million layer. They're between the $50 million and the $70 million layer. They're a first layer insurer right smack in the middle of the trigger period. We have $126 million of unreimbursed liabilities here, and they're contending that they shouldn't have to pay anything, even though they wrote a policy obligating themselves to pay on an all-sums basis, on a joint and several liability basis, for all claims and expenses that trigger their policy period, which in this case total $126 million of ultimate net loss, and they're contending they should pay nothing.
Well, how do you respond to the argument in their briefs that these defense costs really can be allocated and that DuPont has a fairly sophisticated summary that if you extrapolate from the summary of claims, you could also apply it to the defense costs?
Okay, well, let's take them one at a time because those $74 million of defense costs break into several different categories. The biggest category is $42 million of what I would call defense costs, that is DuPont paying its lawyers to defend itself all around the country because there was not only class action litigation, there are individual lawsuits from homeowners, from apartment owners, building owners all around the country. And they spent a total of $42 million. Some of that was for National Coordinating Council, others for individual cases in individual jurisdictions. Now, President Judge Vaughn put the burden on them, that is on the insurers, that if they could prove that any of those dollars were the sole and exclusive result of claims by post-86 insurers for which they had no coverage obligation, that those could be deducted. They were put to that burden and they failed. They provided no evidence in the record to suggest that any of these expenses for actual legal fees were the result of a case that involved only post-86 claims. The reality is there were over 200 lawsuits. And in these lawsuits, there were multiple plaintiffs. Many of them had their polybutylene systems installed in 83, some in 84, some in 85. What Stonewall was suggesting is that you, first of all, only take one of those 200 cases, the class action case, and that you look at the claims who have been paid, or when I say paid, they've actually had their plumbing systems replaced, and that you should allocate the defense costs, the $42 million, among those claims years based on the percentage that we've talked about already with regard to the actual claims expenses. That is presumably 44% for the pre-86 period and 55% for the post-86 period. But there's no evidence in the record, after they were given the burden to provide an evidence, there's no evidence in the record that any of those are specifically and solely the result of post-86 insurers. They're just asking for an equitable allocation, not based on any policy language or any law. They're just saying it's not fair that we have to pay or be held responsible to pay for the full amount. But that's what their policy says. You know, many times the original
argument.
What's
the consequence of the all sums provision?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
But there shouldn't have to be an allocation.
There is, right. The policies specifically say that the policyholder is entitled to be paid in full for all of those claims, dollars, and litigation expenses that trigger their policy period. Now, if they think that that's unfair in any respect, they certainly have the ability, after they make the policyholder whole, to then seek some contribution claim against some of the other insurers who they think didn't pay their fair share.
Let me make sure I understand that point. You're not saying that litigation costs that could be solely allocated to a post-1985 or a 1986 claim triggers a 1985 policy. You're simply saying that they've put forward no proof, even at summary judgment stage, that would entitle them to a factual hearing on the extent to which there are pre-1985 litigation costs as opposed to post-1985 litigation costs.
Vaughn
ruled as he did?
That's exactly right, Chief Justice Steele. They have not. There's no evidence in the record that they adduced, and President Judge Vaughn found that there was no principled basis on which to allocate these litigation costs among specific claims. They had the ability to do that. They didn't do it. There's no evidence in the record to suggest it. And, in fact, the reality is that nearly all of these litigation costs involve large universes of claimants who would have installations that would span all throughout the 83 to 89 period when these installations were taking place. And so I think they would be hard-pressed, even if given a second try, to be able to prove that there was some substantial amount of litigation costs that were solely attributable to post-86 claims. So that was the first category, the $42 million of litigation defense costs. Then there's $12 million that we paid DuPont in plaintiff's counsel fees in the class action settlement. They contend that $12 million is really the responsibility of the claimants, and therefore that $12 million should be equitably distributed among the policy years where those claimants fall, the same probably 44 to 55% split. And again, they cited a couple of cases which really are inapposite here. Those are cases where there was
Before we go to the cases, is it correct that whatever jurisdiction and whatever judge in that jurisdiction presided over the class action claim had the terms of the settlement presented to him or her and approved it? Is that correct?
Sure, absolutely.
So if there was an option for the claimant class or the plaintiff class or the fund created for the plaintiffs to pay the cost of litigation, or DuPont as a part of the settlement offered to pay the cost of litigation, that scenario was approved by the judge as a matter of an equitable settlement, correct?
In those other cases, yes.
So maybe I'm missing something, but why is there an issue later about who should have paid the cost of litigation if it was resolved in that proceeding?
Maybe I don't understand the question, but in our case, in the class action that DuPont settled, the Spencer class action, there was no common fund that we paid into. We didn't pay a lump sum of money and say, split this up among the claimants, and by the way, take your attorney's fees out of that. What happened in our settlement was we agreed to two things. One, that we would pay directly the plaintiff's counsel fees of $12 million, and number two, that we would set up a facility for the replumbing of claims for those claimants who fit the eligibility.
My only point was this, in trying to understand why this is even in dispute at all, is this isn't a situation where you sat around someone's conference table and hammered out a written settlement agreement between the parties, and there was no court approval. There was an actual judicial post-settlement approval of the terms on the basis that this was a fair way to settle the case, correct?
Right.
That we and under the terms, DuPont, rather than the claimants or plaintiffs, paid the litigation costs.
Absolutely. I mean, that it was our direct obligation, in addition to setting up the facility, the replumbing facility, which would then receive claims from around the country for those who were eligible and they could get their polybutylene pipe systems replumbed into copper. There was never some big cash fund, as there was in the cases that are cited by Mr. Kasperczak in his brief. And so that is the next category. And with regard to, again, similarly, the class action notice costs, which are another $14 million, those, again, are amounts that DuPont was required under the settlement to pay directly as part of the settlement. Not only did they have to pay the plaintiff's counsel fees, pay to set up the facility, they also had to pay to give notice to the world or the potential class members that, hey, you may be eligible to get your plumbing system replumbed, in which case you can make your claim to this facility and we'll send a plumber out there and pull out your PB plumbing system and put in a copper system. Again, the notion that these expenses are somehow divisible among individual claimants by virtue of who among the class of claimants actually has received relief for which we have statistical information as to when their claims were installed, I mean, that's just an artificial construct. We paid this in one lump sum. That was part of our ultimate liability in these cases, and there was no allocation as among claimants for either these costs or for the plaintiff counsel fees. And so President Judge Vaughn properly ruled that these are indivisible costs that are the result of the occurrence as a whole, which trigger any one of these years. And because each of the insurers in each year has overlapping coverage obligation, because of each one has an all sums coverage responsibility, that we could put those dollars to any particular year. And what really this whole case boils down to is that the 85 insurers, and now Stonewall specifically, because they're the last ones that are left in this case, they regret the fact that we chose their year in the first instance to provide all sums coverage. And what they're trying to do is get an extra benefit by being the last holdout in the case. They want to be not disadvantaged by being the last holdout. They want to be advantaged. I suggest, first of all, that they do get the benefit of all of the settlements that we've been able to accomplish over the years, because that reduces our ultimate net loss and it reduces the amount of money that we can put into their year. And they're entitled to that credit because we're not asking for any sort of windfall. We're not asking to get more than we otherwise would.
Well, I know you're almost out of time, but tell us your response to their argument that goes something like this. You never would have gotten the money from XL and ACE unless they were satisfied that you had incurred the $50 million of self-insurance for their policy, period. And therefore, since that's the factual predicate for all the money you got from those two carriers, it should be included in the credit that Stonewall gets when it looks at the big picture.
Well, that's an argument that is divorced from the reality of these kinds of situations where you have multiple years with multiple insurers having overlapping coverage obligations, and we have a lump sum that we're trying to, get as much reimbursement as we can. And the way you settle these cases, and I've done this for 20 years, and so I'm very intimately familiar with the process, is that you make your best claim against each of the insurers in each of the years, and you arm wrestle, and you negotiate, and you try to get whatever you can get and put together through individual bilateral agreements a pot of money that makes you, if not happy, at least not so unhappy that you're willing to settle rather than to continue to litigate. And the notion that just because we settled with a particular insurer, that's an acknowledgement that we must have exhausted all of their underlying coverage, and therefore any insurer in another year gets the benefit of that. That's not the reality of how these negotiations work. And number two, if that rule were adopted, that is that any time you settle with an insurer, you not only lose you not only have to give a credit to the other year's overlapping insurer obligations, how much you've received from the settling insurer, but also the amount of all of their underlying limits, we'll never settle any of these cases.
So, then, as I understand your position, it's analogous to the question I asked your opponent. The Superior Court in this case was influenced by the fact that you took a position for settlement that shouldn't bind you in subsequent litigation.
That's absolutely right. We took the same position with them. We took the same position with the 83 and the 84-year insurers, that we wanted to get the maximum recovery from each of them. And that's what you do in litigation. And you obviously then compromise and take less than what you would otherwise be entitled to if you litigated favorably to judgment. And that's how you settle these cases. And the rule that they propose would greatly diminish the chance of early settlements of these kinds of complex cases.
Thank you very much, counsel.
I'd just like to make a few comments, initially also saying that the post-86 allocation of claims we're talking about, this litigation has not had a specific end date of claims determined, so we don't know the specific end date while we know the beginning date. The fact that DuPont is trying to make a differentiation of either 50 or 60% of the claims, the fact is they allocated claims, as Justice Holland indicated, that were predicated upon the settlement and part of the settlement with ACE and Excel. Whatever that amount is, we're looking for a credit for that amount. We're not trying to say that it's a specific dollar amount. So looking at either the earlier or the later agreement on the terms of the percentages of claims is not at issue. It's regarding whether or not we get credit for that amount of claims that were tendered. And I would just refer also when DuPont represented that in its letters to Danube, which is its carrier, and then it's actually ACE and Excel are the reinsurers in this situation at A748 and A485 and 486, wherein its Danube also tendered the letter to DuPont stating that the Delrin liabilities exceeded the $50 million SIR, which was the self-insured retention, again representing the fact that they had met and satisfied those claims. These insurance program has individual self-insured retentions for each policy period, which is a year. You can't say that you have only one retention when you're dealing with that particular carrier and then it doesn't exist when you deal with another one. We knew that the insurance companies that insured the 83 and 84 year both also in their policies have a separate $50 million SIR below their policies. So the fact that you can try to say that it doesn't exist and that it wasn't satisfied doesn't really take DuPont's position of what they bargained for in setting up their liability program.
Well, as I understand Mr. Sylvester's position, it is your client is entitled to a credit on a pro rata basis or whatever for whatever the other carriers paid that are liable on the all claims, all sums. But that as far as DuPont's concerned, you only get one $50 million self-insurance reserve.
Well, that's the position they're taking, but that's contrary, first of all, to the opinion which says that Judge Vaughn's opinion that says that they have to take a SIR for each period that they select to submit claims. So theoretically, if they're submitting claims, they're taking the narrow view of we're just submitting it to the 85 policy year. But if they go through that policy year and they continue to have claims and aren't satisfied, they're going to have to go to another policy period, submit them, and then take another $50 million SIR because they're going to another period. They can't take the whole program and say that it's one $50 million SIR when it specifically says that only claims that come within that period can trigger that period. And that's when the all sums distinction is. It's not all sums for all their liability. It's all sums for liabilities that come through that policy period. And that's all we're trying to determine here. So again,
isn't that the part of the Superior Court opinion where they were making the distinction between litigation and settlement? And the problem, as I understand that you're focusing on, is everyone agrees it would be a different result, two $50 million SRIs, if everything had been litigated. But the fact that they weren't litigated is the reason we have this appeal.
That's the distinction they're trying to make. We're saying it shouldn't be a distinction because basically DuPont's looking to get reimbursed for its liabilities for polybutylene pipe systems. They're going to their insurers in different ways, whether they arbitrate, they come to court. They're looking to satisfy those claims, and it's under the pursuant to the policies that they have in place with all their insurers, which have the terms and conditions that require and were specifically set up with the self-insured retention. So for them to try to use a different avenue in saying, oh, well, we went this way because of arbitration, therefore that doesn't come into play with yours because we litigated it, or vice versa, you know, that's not being true on their part of what they contracted for and as part of their overall program. I would just like to comment briefly, too, on the defense costs that DuPont's trying to shift or state now that they're not able to allocate litigation costs when in part of the factual submission that they made to ACE and Excel, they did actually have a breakout which was required of them, and now they're trying to say that they're shifting the burden to us, and I think that's inequitable, and given the facts, we should be given credit for that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement for assessment.